Colin Kaepernick of the San Francisco 49ers sat during the playing of the national anthem. Swimmer Ryan Lochte misbehaved in Rio, then lied about it. That begs a question. Should we hold our star athletes to a higher standard than we do other people? On the one hand, many people place them on pedestals because they're public figures and often do extraordinary things. But on the other hand, they're just people, whether we want them to be or not. We're going to sort this out this morning with our ethics professors, and later we'll dive into the question facing universities these days. Should universities bend over backwards to be politically correct and accommodating, or should they allow for free speech and thought, even if it makes others uncomfortable? Tough questions, but we've got a couple of tough ethics professors here with us today. Wayne Vaught is the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He also is a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics, and he's one of my bosses over at UMKC. Wayne, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Clancy Martin is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. His latest book is titled Bad Sex. And Clancy, good morning to you.
Thanks so much for having us, Steve.
Colin Kaepernick didn't stand for the Star Spangled Banner, as is custom at our sporting events. He's making a statement about the treatment of African Americans. What do you make of it, Wayne?
Well, it gets into sort of a general conversation we're having, one about free speech issues and about one's ability to protest and to make a statement.
Is there any question that he has the right to do what he's doing?
Well, I certainly think that he's constitutionally protected to do what he's doing. There's nothing mandatory about requiring or forcing someone to do something, especially in terms of the national anthem. But it does raise questions about the method about which one goes about engaging and the style in which one goes about engaging in public discourse. Well, I mean, there are ways in which to get the message a certain message across. You can do things are they going to be more persuasive if you do A, B, or C versus X, Y, or Z? And the question is, in this situation, particularly around that particular custom, one question would be, has he done more to help his cause or more to hurt his cause because he's alienated or infuriated people around something like that?
Now, that sure has gotten a lot of attention, Wayne.
He has absolutely gotten a lot of attention. So then the question would be for him. I mean, I certainly defend an individual's right to do so, to come out and say what he is saying, bringing attention to that fact. Now the question will be, how does that conversation on go? What is it that he's able to make of this as he tries to bring attention to the issues that he wants to bring attention to?
Because he says he's going to continue sitting.
Yeah.
So the tension's going to continue.
Absolutely. I think it will for a while until it subsides. Because, you know, once he continues to do that, if there's no follow-up, if there's no real engagement in what the issues are, I think that will eventually, people will stop paying attention to him doing that.
Clancy Martin, Wayne raises the question of whether Colin Kaepernick has furthered his cause or undermined it by doing what he's doing with the attention he's generating, both positively and negatively, negative attention. What do you make of it?
Well, that question is, of course, often comes up in the context of conscientious objection. I want us to sort of remember the history of moral conscientious objection in this context which is very deep. Mm-hmm. If you think of Mahatma Gandhi in South Africa, when he was participating in the burning of the passes, a lot of the press said that he was hurting the immigrant population in South Africa rather than helping the cause of the immigrant population in South Africa. Now, I'm not suggesting that this fellow is Mahatma Gandhi, but there's something actually Wayne is an expert on is the role of conscientious objection in the context of one's professional obligations. And so if we think of a pharmacist, for example, on the grounds of conscientious objection, refusing to prescribe a particular drug because she considers it to be opposed to her morality. That's a good example of a very difficult case. We've also seen recently conscientious objection in the case of a legal clerk refusing to perform gay marriage. What we need to think about is, do we think that as a professional athlete, as a professional, one has some kind of professional obligation to represent the team and sort of, I suppose, by implication, the supporters of the team, et cetera, in terms of standing up for America, something like that? Or is it not really a matter of professional obligation in this context, and it's really a matter of the individual's moral conscience and what he considers to be an obligation to a larger question that is independent of his professional ethics? And it seems
How do you answer that? I mean, does he have an obligation to his team to ask the team president, you know, you're paying my paycheck, do you mind if I sit during the national anthem?
As far as I can tell, I do think that when it comes to public figures, generally speaking, our professional obligations get much more confusing than they do when we are merely a private figure. And a professional athlete in our country is a kind of public figure. There's no question about it. And so if a politician, it may not be disanalogous from the case of a politician who were refusing to stand up during the national anthem. And imagine what a firestorm that would result in for that individual. But again, if the person is doing it on the grounds of conscience and a source of what they feel of legitimate protest and the best way of making a statement about an injustice they're wanting to call our attention to, it's complicated. Yeah. You know, it's not a morally straightforward case. I am tempted to say that we would not say it falls within the domain of a professional athlete's moral obligations to stand during the national anthem, but I admit that it's complicated.
The NFL, I should point out, does not require players to stand and during a team national anthem. They've stated they won't be taking any action against Colin Kaepernick here going forward. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Let me get our listeners involved here. What do you make of what quarterback Colin Kaepernick has done here? And the broader question, should we hold our star athletes to a higher standard than we do other people? Or is that a bunch of hooey? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, Wayne, one thing that surprised me about this whole thing is that I don't recall another athlete agreeing to sit during the national anthem going back any number of years here. And I was almost surprised it hadn't happened before, given that it's on one level, it's a fairly simple action to take in protest of your country's actions, whether it's in a war area or a racial relations area like this.
Right. So you mean there's been no professional athlete who's done this?
Who has sat during the national anthem.
I mean, there certainly have been cases of it happening and of athletes. I know there have been cases at high school levels and other things, but I don't know of, you know, a case where on a sort of a national television at that level of attention of it happening. You're right. I'm unaware of it. And so that in and of itself may be, in his mind, one of the best reasons for doing it is because this, as you said, is bringing an awful lot of attention to why is it that he is doing this. And if it's just, you know, if people were doing things just simply to flaunt tradition or whatever, you might raise question about it. But again, as I said, if there are some legitimate issues that he is, which I clearly think there are legitimate issues that he is concerned about, and this is trying to raise awareness to that cause, it really sort of depends on what he's going to do with that now after he's brought attention to himself. Mm-hmm. If it was just to bring attention.
I mean, he needs to stand up and have a news conference and further explain his grievances against the country?
I guess, you know, my question is, if it's getting to a moral issue, was this an act that was done to bring attention to himself? Or was this done as an action to further a cause that he's deeply committed to?
I think you got to hand it to him at least. This seems to be furthering a cause.
I think
and not bringing attention to himself.
Absolutely right. Yeah. And so and the next steps will sort of help us in terms of weighing the ethical implications of what he's doing, figure out, well, you know, this was an effective way and there have been many instances, certainly in the past and certainly around civil rights issues, where these types of civil disobediences, as it were, have really helped to bring about some significant change.
You look back to the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, where the two black athletes stood up and gave the Black Power salute.
Right. Correct.
John Carlos and I forget the other gentleman's name, but they were, you know, just booed out of the country virtually at the time. But over the years, they now are viewed much differently. I think there's a statue erected to them somewhere that honors what they did in some ways.
Well, that's exactly right. People typically, when they do conscientious objection, particularly standing up for what they believe in, are not generally heralded as heroes at the time.
And the willingness to take a risk and the willingness to bear the consequences, if there are indeed consequences, in which in this particular case, it looks like both of those factors were in place and they're relevant. You know, when if someone is dodging the draft by moving to Canada, we have a rather different a view of that person than somebody who is saying, I refuse to serve and I'm willing to take whatever consequences come from that. And the first, the former case doesn't really look like conscientious objection. It looks like running away. But the latter case looks like, you know, the I sing of Olaf, glad and brave, you know, it's real conscientious objection. And it looks like this fellow must have known he was taking a real risk with his fans, with his team, potentially with the league, and also must have known that there were going to be real consequences, including, I'm sure, you know, members of his family are probably may well be upset depending upon their views about the national anthem.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. The question on the table, should we hold our star athletes to a higher standard? We're talking about Colin Kaepernick's actions and also those of Ryan Lochte, the Olympic swimmer here for the U.S. that got in so much hot water just a couple weeks ago. Jack from Shawnee. Jack, you're on Up to Date with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
There are things more important than symbolism of a flag. What's more important than that is our actual values. And this fellow is patriotic to risk his career to sit down to stand up for what he believes.
Mm-hmm.
So I see him as a patriot.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you agree with what he's doing, Jack?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, not black lives don't matter till all lives matter.
Mm-hmm.
There's a definite problem. And people who ignore that just, you know, they're racists.
Yeah. Okay, I appreciate that, Jack. Thanks very much. Let's go to Laura from Kansas City, Missouri. Laura, good morning. Hi.
Hi. Not only do I support this man's constitutional right to do what he's doing, but I don't understand why we vilify him in such a public way when there are so many members of the NFL who do heinous things. And they get away with it, and they're kept on their teams, and they're allowed to keep playing. And I'll take my comment off air.
Oh, that's interesting. She's talking about domestic violence, drugs, that kind of thing, players remaining on their teams. Does she have a point, Clancy?
Oh, I think so. And this is part of the difference between what we would normally think of as a professional ethical code that we might very well apply to the Olympic swimmer, for example, or to any one of these young men who wind up doing things that are either illegal or highly morally questionable, and we do give them considerably more scrutiny than we might just an ordinary individual, because at the end of the day, being a professional athlete does bring with it a kind of, as a matter of fact, this protest wouldn't work if there wasn't a sort of umbrella of obligation and representation that we see associated with that in the context of the athlete. So,
in other words, we pay attention to this because it's Colin Kaepernick, who's a quarterback.
Exactly. And
professional quarterback. Yeah,
exactly. And this when it is merely a moral infraction that someone is committing because they made some kind of moral mistake, we certainly should view it considerably differently than we view somebody who's engaging in an act of protest.
Mm-hmm. Has he been vilified? Where is public opinion on this? Do we have any sense of that?
You know, I really don't have my sort of fingers on the pulse of really where that is. And it sounds like, especially from our callers, it's probably quite mixed, which is what I would anticipate, that there would be people who are deeply offended and people who are right there supporting and saying he's doing the right thing. And I think this last caller does make an interesting, very interesting point, and it sort of relates to the way you open the conversation, is that do we hold or should athletes be held to a higher standard? And it's, I don't really know that it's a question of should. It's just kind of a matter of fact that athletes are public figures because of the the way and the influence and the power and the media attention that goes into tracking the lives of these athletes, particularly their on and off court or field.
We pay activities. Attention is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. We pay attention. And so you were there doing what you're doing. And, you know, the question is, do we hold them to a higher standard, or is it just the fact that their actions are more publicly visible? And so
they're held accountable in ways that others may not be criticized
in a way that someone who doesn't have that public accountability is going to have the same sort of pressure, I guess, is going to be put on them to behave in a particular way. Because, you know, and I think a lot of this comes to the recognition that athletes are setting a standard for how we expect our children to behave. They look up to them. We sports in and of itself is an incredible teaching ground for morality and social behavior.
And leadership.
And there are so many positive virtues that come from engagement in sport. And so there's a lot intermixed here. It's not just, hey, these guys are out playing football and, you know, why are we paying so much attention to them? There's a lot that's ingrained into what's going on there.
But should there be, though? I mean, why pay so much attention to what these 22-year-old kids do compared to any other 22-year-old? I mean, just because you're a great swimmer like Ryan Lochte, why do we care what he gets arrested and the whole country came to a halt for a couple of days watching that whole drama unfold?
We don't want to be naive about the American cultural relationship with sports. I mean, it's simply the case that so many of these sports heroes are heroes for generations, and they are not merely heroes in the sense of their accomplishment. They're moral heroes.
Well, we don't prepare them for that. What we prepare them for, at least my sense, is they are trained, and the whole ethic is to train and become the best you can be. But then they get there, and suddenly they're in this spotlight, and they no more know how to navigate that than they know how to.
And I think that is absolutely true. Yeah. And I think the thing is with athletes is that they do have influence in the way that normal 22-year-olds don't.
Yeah.
Professional athletes performing in that environment with that attention, they do influence. And they influence in a way that some guys playing pickup football on the weekend are never going to influence, no matter what they do or how many DUIs or whatever it is that they're engaging in that's problematic. And it's not that we say, well, your behavior is justified and yours are not. It's just the fact that, matter of fact, you're in an environment where you're having influence. And does the fact that you now have influence create some higher level of ethical obligation on you to behave in a certain way?
It seems to me we should prepare them for that, then. If that's what the reality is, throwing these kids onto the world stage with 80, 90, 150 million eyeballs, just parsing every move they make, maybe that needs to be higher on the
address.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right, Steve. There's no question about it that every professional sports organization ought to be thinking about, at least post Lance Armstrong, are we helping these kids to keep their eye on the ball, morally speaking?
I teach 22-year-old kids, and some of them could handle it. I'm telling you, most of them could not.
And some don't want to be. 120
million eyballs.
We can think about NBA players of the past who've said, I am no role model. I'm not here to be a role model. That's not my job, and they don't want any part of it.
I think Charles Barkley makes that point for
absolutely,
the NBA.
Absolutely, did.
Barbara from Liberty. Barbara, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the role and the position of athletes in our society. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Barbara.
Really, my comment is, just because you can doesn't always mean you should. And I really support individual choice, but that's what it boils down to, is individual choice. And I think we're more often judged for our choices than our abilities. While I support the American way, and thank goodness we can stand up and say no when we think that that's wrong, but that doesn't always mean that's what we should do.
And so in this case,
you understand what I'm saying?
I think so. So in this case, you're saying you're still not sure that Colin Kaepernick did the right thing?
Well, for himself, yes. But sometimes I think you have to look at what you were just saying before, who you influence, and is it going to help your cause or make it worse?
And so I gather you're suggesting that he has not helped his cause here.
Well, I think maybe he's a young man that's very idealistic, and that doesn't always mean that you should exercise your right. You know what I mean? Maybe you should keep it private or do something in your own way instead of making a choice that may hurt you and the cause that you're trying to help later.
Right. Okay, Barbara, I appreciate the comments. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Let me go to Matt from Baldwin. Matt, good morning.
Good morning. You know, honestly, I would respond to the last caller by saying, if not now, when? I mean, I think someone has to stand up and say what Mr. Kaepernick is saying. And I wanted to speak to the way the question here is being framed. As it sounded, and I'd like some clarification, that maybe that these two things are equivalent, that Mr. Kaepernick's action and Mr. Lochte's actions were somehow, you know, similar, as if they, I think certainly Mr. Lochte violated a standard. I think actually Mr. Kaepernick is really upholding a standard of a form of civil or cultural disobedience that really has a much higher goal in mind than, you know, the artifact of a night of partying.
Yes. Great point. Yeah, I mean, our moral intentions are always relevant to assessing the morality of a particular action or situation. And the fact of the matter is these fellows look like they have radically different intentions, morally speaking. One is to stand up for a cause of social justice. The other is hard to discern, probably just some kind of moral mistake.
And what, you know, what we find, and I think may moral... people of moral character or moral exemplars are not often recognized at the time in which they're engaging in the actions that they would. Thomas More, Clancy, that we've talked about, the issue of Thomas More was a chancellor under Henry VIII and had stood up to Henry VIII when Henry VIII had signed the Act of Succession, or Thomas More refused to sign the Act of Succession, which would have separated the church separated England from the church from the Roman Catholic Church, and it was very, you know, in some ways very similar. Thomas More was embracing his ideologies. He was saying, "Look, I can't acquiesce to what the government is in this case expecting me to do because it deeply violates my particular religious beliefs and traditions." And what I think you would see here with the refusal to stand is not quite exactly the same sort of thing, but it's along the lines of someone saying, there are certain things that the government is doing that I so deeply object to that I cannot in good faith now stand up, quite literally, stand up and say I'm supporting the government to which this anthem is associated.
And to get to Matt's point, I guess the two athletes are linked only in the sense that we are paying so much attention to these respective acts.
Oh, absolutely,
and
right.
And questioning, why do we? Are these athletes deserving of so much of our attention, I guess is maybe the point here. Catherine from Lansing. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Hi.
Hi. My thought on this is that I studied social work in college, and one of the things that I believe I learned was that for a group or class of people who are without voice and without power to gain a voice and to gain power, somebody who has a voice and power is going to be much more effective in bringing attention to that situation. So that by his doing this, indeed, it focuses on people who generally don't have a lot of power, don't have a lot of influence, and, you know, they could march on City Hall all day and say, we want things to be better, and nobody would much pay attention. So, and it was a significant consequence that Colin Kaepernick, he got in a lot of trouble with a lot of people who real upset with him.
Right. Well, and I appreciate those comments. Here's the really interesting dilemma for the 49ers. Apparently, Kaepernick regardless of this particular action, is very much on the bubble in terms of his ability to make the team this year based on his athletic abilities alone, based on SI.com, Sports Illustrated, which I tend to read sometimes. If he gets cut, look out. That's going to be interesting. Yeah. Leslie from Overland Park, we're going to wrap up with you, Leslie, before a break here. Good morning.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to a lot of the people. I feel really the same way. I really admire Kaepernick. I'm on social media way too much, but I see a very positive response toward him. I'll make a note that people who are afraid to offend someone never really get to make their true point. Mm-hmm. Someone has pointed out that the full lyrics of the Star Spangled Banner, there's one verse that celebrates the murder of slaves. Mm-hmm. So some people are speaking up about that. A lot of the backlash that I've seen, people getting mad, it's because of the flag itself, and I remind them that the flag is an inanimate object, and it will get over the snubbing. And as Kaepernick himself said in a press conference, he's not disrespecting the military. Veterans died for the right of people to be able to speak their minds. And in the meantime, we're not taking care of our veterans. Our veterans are killing themselves at a crazy rate. So it's really a pretty complicated thing. And I love how people online are tying it all together. And, there's a lot of admiration for Kaepernick.
Yeah. Leslie, thank you for the good call. Appreciate it. Andre emailed us this. Your analyst is 100% incorrect about Kaepernick's constitutional right to do this. The Constitution does not protect citizens against their companies and organizations, in this case, the NFL. The Constitution protects him against the actions of the government. If the NFL or the team decides to censor him, they are 100% within their rights to do so. Lynn wrote to ask about that third verse of the Star Spangled Banner. If the quarterback makes a private statement, no one, including you, Mr. Kraske, will be talking about freedom of speech, but you have not talked about the third verse of our national anthem. What say you? Clancy, you've taken a look at that third verse.
Yes. As far as I can tell, and I'm not an expert on the national anthem, but as far as I can tell, what is being defended there is the fact that in 1812, when we were at war with the British, we chased out a nation of conscripts, and it looks like that's what they're celebrating, the fact that the conscripts and indentured militia of the British were successfully chased off of our soil. But, you know, as I say, I'm not a scholar of the national anthem.
We're visiting this hour with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin, both from UMKC. Let's turn to a different topic, gentlemen. John Ellison, the Dean of Students at the University of Chicago, recently wrote a letter to new students in which he said very bluntly that the university will not cancel speakers because they might prove controversial. The university also said, will not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own. All this has sparked a national debate over safe spaces and trigger warnings in which students might be warned of controversial material. Other college presidents across the country are now urging more engagement with uncomfortable ideas. The question on the table, should universities bend over backwards to be politically correct, or should they allow for free speech and thought, even if it makes others uncomfortable? Wayne, you're the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC. What's your chief concern, political correctness or sometimes making your students uncomfortable with ideas they must confront in the classroom?
The Dean of Arts and Sciences, so here we go. I think that a university, in terms of the language that's being used, the safe zones, the trigger warnings, the various types of things that we see that are there to sort of protect, I think sometimes certainly gets taken to the extreme, and I think that that's what we're seeing at the University of Chicago. Quite frankly, I think a university should be an intellectual safe zone, the whole university, in the sense that we are here to teach people how to engage in controversial ideas.
And do so in a comfortable
way. In a way in which, you know, you're not going to allow speech on campus or shouldn't that is racist, that is demeaning, that is designed specifically to attack, to harm, to cause injury to someone else. That, I think, and that there's no constitutional protection for that type of speech.
Mm-hmm.
So we recognize that. But if you get through your college career and you've never been offended, if you've never encountered an idea that made you uncomfortable, that you've never done anything that put you in a position where you were hearing things that you just didn't like, I think that you've not had a very good college experience. And it's one of the things that Clancy and I do in a course that we teach, Money, Medicine, and Morals on campus. The course is designed to push people into an uncomfortable zone, to force them to think about issues like abortion or end-of-life decision-making and euthanasia, a lot of the things that are hot topic items in the press. We want to take people into an area where they feel uncomfortable. We want to push them to think about things that, in ways that they've never heard before. The other day in class, we were talking, and the issue that came up was actually something as benign as drinking, which some may or may not think is benign, but we heard different religious perspectives were coming up in class. So there was a Muslim, there was Catholic, there was a Protestant. You had all of these different ideas, and some of those I don't think particularly was as early in the class. At some point, I'm hoping that it will make people uncomfortable, but uncomfortable in the sense that this is just something I'm not familiar with, but you've got to get them in an environment. Now, what you don't want to do is to create just kind of, Clancy and I, one of the things that we'll do in class, particularly around end-of-life decision-making, euthanasia, we show a video. It was on 60 Minutes. Students will watch someone being euthanized. They will see a man die on video, and we show this as part of the class. And we regularly, and Clancy will say before, we'll tell them what's going to happen. And, you know, is that a trigger warning? Is that creating a safe zone? I think that there are certainly circumstances where it's appropriate to give someone forewarning as to something that's really going to be kind of out of line of what you might expect. But it's not that we're not going to show the video. It's not that we're not going to provide a place for people to discuss what's happening. We want there to be a safe zone for people to discuss ideas that make them deeply offended or controversial. So I don't know if that answers the question, but if the idea of a safe zone is creating a place where, I don't want to be confronted with things that might upset me, that I think is problematic in a university.
And yet, Clancy, we're a society that seems to me we're increasingly, moving away from a confrontation. We're moving away from uncomfortable ideas. We all read, we make our media selections based on those media outlets that tend to conform to my personal way of thinking, and we stay away from others, Fox News, MSNBC being the two most popular ones that get kicked around here. So society's in a different place than what you guys are suggesting.
Right. And I think that's exactly right, that there is a kind of homogenization and polarization of thinking, of talking, of opinion. And not to just simply repeat what Wayne has said, but this for me, I know speaking personally of my own college experience, when I got there, I had a pretty set view of the world, and I thought I knew what was what. And then I got to college, and I took some classes, and they weren't my chemistry classes. Actually, I made the mistake of taking a philosophy class, and the road less traveled by. But anyway, it shook me up, and all of a sudden, a lot of things that I thought I knew to be true, I found out, wow, these are a lot more complicated than I initially supposed. And it wasn't because, I went to a tiny liberal arts college, which was actually a very protected space in the sense in which Wayne is just describing. Right. It was a very, very polite place, to be frank. But the ideas that were being put out were highly controversial and really shook me up. And I don't think that the University of Chicago or anywhere else, they are trying to encourage or protect people who are engaging in, sticks and stones may break my bones kinds of conversation, that genuinely harmful conversation. What they're trying to do is to say, look, if there's one place in America where we will address the homogenization of ideas and the homogenization of opinions, where we will allow ideas of all different kinds to flourish, it has to be the college campus.
Well, I was going to say, do you think in this era of political correctness, gentlemen, that faculty members, not just at UMKC, but everywhere, have started shying away from challenging their students with uncomfortable ideas out of a fear of being offensive and being written up somewhere?
You know, I don't know. I think that probably does happen in some cases. I've not heard anything at UMKC of a faculty member coming to me and saying, you know, hey, I feel I can't now teach the subject matter. And as a matter of fact, we, Clancy and I, teach, I think, what probably is some of the most controversial subject matter on campus, or at least in the college, in our classes. And I, as a dean, would absolutely fundamentally support every faculty member's right to do so. You know, there have been some, I will say there have been some cases where, you know, I've known of students who have complained about, not formally, but I've kind of heard or they complain because this instructor was talking about X, Y, or Z. But I don't recall the story being that the instructor changed their curricula because of that. Now,
Do students in your classes complain to anybody saying, hey, they're talking about abortion, they're talking about euthanasia, and I'm having trouble with that? I mean,
I've been teaching, gosh, for 20 years. It's hard to believe that, but not at UMKC, but 18 years at UMKC, and I've never had that occur.
And I do want to say, Steve, that I think some of the confusion enters in here with the word political correctness, because there are standards of speech that a professor has to adhere to, and those include not engaging in hateful, racist, or sexist speech. And that's entirely appropriate. That's just us being careful in our speech. Now, that doesn't mean we still can't engage in extremely provocative ideas.
Well, you've been careful in your speech today, and you've stirred up the masses once again. Our two ethics professors, Wayne Vaught from UMKC, Clancy Martin. Gentlemen, thanks very much.
Thank you so much,
Steve.